Good afternoon. So last time we talked about the reason why we do register renaming. You mentioned that when we're doing this out of order execution idea, we need different versions of registers at the same time because we have instructions that are consuming different versions of those. So ultimately, we need multiple versions of the registers. So a solution that solves that problem and also ends up simplifying our bookkeeping is to assign a new physical register, as we put it, for each version of one of the registers we saw in assembly. Then we went through applying this idea to building a pipeline that would run instructions out of order and be able to, you know, using that mechanism handle, fetching big bundles of instructions and running them. And we saw that our pipeline was longer than our five-stage one we had for our in-order processor, but we had kind of a piece that worked like our in-order processor at the beginning, and then we had our out-of-order stuff, and then we had another piece that worked kind of like our in-order processor. We have these two in-order pieces. The first one takes bundles of instructions and does our pre-processing on them, including the register renaming. Then we have a piece that we're going to talk about more today, which takes those instructions that we pre-processed and actually runs them. And then we have a piece at the end which finalizes instructions. And this is something we need so we can handle things like, what if there's a seg fault or a branch miss prediction? We want to go back to the state at a particular instruction, and we want to hide the fact that we were running instructions out of order. We want to just, you know, keep the instructions before a certain point and discard the instructions after, even though we might have started working on the instructions after and even computed their final results. And applying this pipeline, last time we looked a bunch at the mechanics of how we deal with renaming registers. And we're going to move on to talking about how these two steps, the issue and execute, work. But before I do that, questions on these topics from last time, so we're prepared to talk about how the issue and execute steps work. Okay, so here's where we are in the pipeline. We have our instruction queue. We're going to assume, to keep things simple, that we have one big instruction queue. In real processors, you'll often find they will divide it up into several separate queues. And we also have some register ready info. And we're going to combine these to actually send instructions to one of several of what we'll call execution or functional units. The name execution units, this is what, you know, actually does the work of the instruction. In our out of order pipelines, we'll generally sort of lump in execution as in doing arithmetic and execution as in doing a memory access in the same place. So this is might be the state of our issue stage. We have an instruction queue that the rename step filled in for us, and we're assuming here that we have a pretty full one. And we did branch prediction already. So I have instructions that are after a conditional jump that we predicted. That prediction might end up being wrong. We're not going to handle that here. That's going to be handled elsewhere. What we are going to handle here is that we're going to execute the jump instruction. And executing a jump instruction, what's that going to look like? We're going to check the condition codes and see if we need to trigger all the operations to undo the future instructions and fetch new stuff. That's where our checking for is our prediction correct is going to happen. That's why it's actually something we need to put on an ALU to do all that checking, which is, you know, checking the condition codes. And I'm going to assume for this example that we have two ALUs and we need to assign the instructions to them. And we need to know what instructions are ready, so we're going to have what we'll call a scoreboard indicating for each physical register whether it's ready or not. And we're going to scan through every single instruction in this instruction queue and check whether its input registers are ready. So I'm going to look at instruction 1. Is input register 1 ready? Yes, it is. Is input register 5 ready? Yes, it is. Therefore, that's a candidate for me to issue. So I can put it in one of the ALUs, and I'll just arbitrarily choose to put it in the first one, and then we'll keep going. So I'll look at instruction 2. Is register 2 ready? Yes. Is register 6 ready? No. So I can't issue that one. I'll look at instruction 3. Is register 3 ready? Yes. Is register 7 ready? Nope. So can't issue that one. And I'm going to keep going here, and I'm going to find out that even though I have 9 instructions here, only one of them is runnable. Kind of disappointing. And so what we'll end up with is we issued instruction 1 and during cycle 1, and we had to leave our other ALU doing nothing. We couldn't find anything for it to do. And after this cycle completes, we're going to be able to, you know, cross off this instruction and mark register 6, the one it writes to, is ready. So in setting up for cycle 2, we're going to say, okay, now I've updated my scoreboard to say, well, we already did the ALU operation for instruction 1, so register 6 is ready, and we're going to repeat our process. So I'm going to now look at this new state and say, can I run instruction 2? Well, register 2 is ready. Register 6 is ready. Yes, I can. Can I run instruction 3? Register 3 is ready. Register 7 is not ready. So, no, I can't. And we'll find out that, once again, we can only actually really run instruction 2. So we will issue instruction 2, and we'll prepare for cycle 3. And in cycle 3, well, register 7 is now ready. So, and you finish instruction 2. So we're going to look for what we can do now. So we finish instruction 2. We're going to look for what can we do now. Register 3 is ready. Register 7 is ready, since instruction 2 would have just finished during cycle 3. Register 4 is ready. Register 8 is not. Register 9 is not ready. Register 8 is not ready still. 10, and so on. So we'll find out we only have one thing we can run, and it's instruction 3. So far, our idea to put 2 ALUs in this processor has not paid off. So then, during our next cycle, things are a little better. So here, we've just finished instruction 3, so we marked register 8 is ready, and now I look at instruction 4. Register 4 is ready, register 8 is ready, so we can issue this one. I look at instruction 5. Register 9 is not ready, so I can't issue that. Look at instruction 6. Register 1 is ready. Register 8 is ready, so I can issue that one. Instruction 7. Register 2 is ready. Register 10 is not. Can't issue that. Same with 8 and 9. But I can issue 4 and 6. So now I finally have a use for my other ALU. And we've gotten an advantage of, you know, not only running instructions as they're available, but running multiple at a time. So we have an advantage of an out-of-order processor. We skipped over evaluating the condition codes until we actually compute them, whereas in our pipeline processor, we would have stalled here. We had to wait here to do this. And we skipped ahead to something in the next iteration of the loop. And we're doing 2 operations at once. So we got, finally, an advantage. So then, those 2 operations are going to complete, making registers 9 and 10 ready, and we're going to process what instructions can we issue now. Well, register 9 is ready, and register 2 is ready, and register 10 is ready, so I can issue instructions 5 and 7. So we're going to issue 5 and 7, during cycle 5. And that's going to make register 11 be ready. And then during cycle 6, we're going to see, okay, well, is register 3 ready? Yes. Is register 11 ready? Yeah, we just finished instruction 7. And then I'm going to ask, is register 4 ready? It is. Is register 12 ready? It is not. So we're just going to issue instruction 8, and then we can do instruction 9 finally. So you can see here our process is every cycle we look at what instructions we can run. We try to find one to fill each of the slots we have. And assuming we can do so, you know, that's what we'll get. And there's this kind of disappointing thing, which is a real problem these our out of order processors have, which is often we'll have a ton of instructions that we fetched and we can't run many of them. And that's just because we don't write programs very often in a way where we expose lots of things to do in parallel. We do things that build on the previous operations, and you just can't do all of those at the same time. So, I showed kind of us having sort of two ALUs that could do, you know, any of our instructions. More commonly, we're going to have specialized execution units. So in this example, I have an ALU and the data cache, which can do loads and stores. And part of what this this issue stage needs to do is to match up the instructions to the execution units that can run them. So for example here, this move queue from memory to register 6, you know, well, let's look at its inputs. It needs register 4. That's ready. It can run. So I'm going to say put it here. And I have to assign it to the data cache because the data cache is the thing that knows how to load from memory. I can look at my second move queue here. It needs register 5, which is ready. But I can't put it anywhere. The only place it can go is into the data cache. I only have one slot for that. It doesn't matter I have this ALU free. The ALU doesn't know how to load a value from memory. So I'm going to leave this instruction 2 that I could run right away sitting there once I've decided to put instruction 1 there instead. I could have also put instruction 2 instead of instruction 1, and that's kind of an arbitrary choice. But then I have this add, so I need register 1, register 2, those are both ready, so I can issue this, and this is going to go in my ALU slot. So then, let's say we're done with that first cycle, so what's going to happen is, well, we finish instruction 1 and instruction 3, and instruction 1 writes to register 6, so that's now ready, and instruction 1 writes to register, sorry, instruction 1 writes to, yes, yeah, and instruction 3 writes to register 8, so that's not ready, and now in cycle 2, I repeat that analysis for what instructions can we run, and we don't need to worry about instruction 1, which we finished, and instruction 3, which we finished. And I'm going to find that it's still the case I can run instruction 2. And I can look at instruction 4 and say, needs register 1, that's ready. Needs register 6, that's now ready. So we can run this one. So I will end up putting instruction 2 with the data cache. I can't put it anywhere else. You need to use the data cache. And I'll put instruction 4. I'll just shoot on the ALU, and we'll keep going, and we'll end up that we'll put instruction 5 in cycle 4. So we have this issue, so we have to pay attention to where can the instructions go. That's going to affect sort of the order and when we can run them. So I've so far shown us having the work of the instructions done in one cycle, but often that won't be possible. So often we'll have functional units, execution units, that take more than one cycle. And there's kind of two ways that can happen. So one way is that we can have a pipelined execution unit. So here I'm showing a pipeline ALU. So this would be common, for example, for an integer multiply. We'll have some circuitry that doesn't multiply, but it does the multiply in multiple steps over multiple cycles. But it's pipelined, so we can start one multiply every cycle, but it's going to take us three cycles to get the answer. And we also will often have some similar machinery for actually how the data cache works. Like, we could build a data cache that gives us the answer in one cycle, but very often we'll figure out, oh, maybe it makes more sense to build a data cache where, like, we spend one cycle looking up the index, another cycle checking the tag, or something like that, and the data cache will take two or three cycles to get our answer, even though we can give it a new address every cycle. So we'll have this pipeline design. So let's say I'm running this code, I'm doing this multiplication, and this is my ALU that this multiplies. How long is it going to take to do this computation? So let me plan it out. If I'm thinking of how this is going to look in assembly, if written with the parentheses like this, I'm going to do multiply C and D into temp. I'm going to multiply B and temp into another temp, and multiply A and temp 2 into temp 3. Right. That's how this is going to turn into instructions if we obey the parentheses. We'll see that these parentheses kind of get us in trouble here. And we could do better if we're allowed to change how those parentheses work. And I say if we're allowed, well, one reason we wouldn't be allowed is that if we have these instructions, well, we could maybe rearrange things, but it's a little harder to do from the instructions. And also, with floating point, the order matters because of rounding. So with floating point instructions, processors are not allowed to change the order, even if it would be convenient for them. So let's do these computations. So I'm going to do this operation. So I'm going to start it. And then it's going to take three cycles. And I'd really like to do one of the other multiplies right away. But I can't do that because I need to take the result of this multiply and feed it into the next thing. So even though our multiplier can do, you know, has these three stages, maybe probably a better way of writing this would be that we can say we're going to do step one, step two, step three, three cycles. And then we're going to feed the result from step three into the second multiply operation. It's going to do its three steps. And then we're going to feed the result of that into the third one. And this ends up being nine cycles. Questions how I got that answer of nine cycles? So if we rearranged this multiply a little bit, and instead we computed A times B times C times D, we can do better. So we can do this schedule, where each of these lines just represents three different multiply instructions again. They just have different dependencies. So we'll do stage one, stage two, stage three, and we can and C and D, we could also start immediately, but if we only have one multiplier here, right, we have to choose one thing to go first, because there's only one set of inputs we can give. So I can put C times D right behind A times B with a single multiplier. If we had a second multiplier, we could put them two in two different multipliers. and we do this a little faster. And then once I have the results from both of these, I can start my final multiply. And so this ends up giving me 7 cycles. And if I had a second ALU like this, not just one, I could get it down to 6 cycles. Some questions on sort of how our pipelined execution works. Yeah.
So I know for the register files, you said we could start reading like when another register was like writing back.
Yeah.
I guess in this case, we can't like start the first stage when another one's in stage 3.
Question, this is when we can't start the first stage when another's in stage 3. So, so you're saying like, can't we do some sort of sharing to make that work? And the answer is that's not, if that was possible, then probably whatever we're doing there lets us turn this into a 2-cycle ALU instead, and that would be a much better idea. The assumption is that if it takes 3 stages, that it's really near the end of the last stage that the result's available, and there's not something useful beforehand. Does that answer your question? But with the write-back stage, with our register file, well, there was we know that the result was usefully available earlier, so that sort of shortcutting was very possible. Does that make sense? Other questions? Okay, so some of our functional units will look like this. And this is how we'll have, we'll be able to support things like multiplies, which are kind of hard to do fast in a single cycle, but we'll get a new multiply done every cycle using pipelining, and we'll combine that with our out-of-order execution. We also might have some functional units that take variable time. So for example, integer divide, it is usually implemented in a way which, something like hand-long division, and that has a variable number of steps depending on the numbers we get. But we can deal with that, so we'll have some circuit where we can't submit values every cycle because it's not pipeline, it only can hold so many, probably only one set of values. And it will have something to tell the issue logic, that stuff that's looking at that instruction queue, whether it's ready or not. And something to tell the write-back logic whether, and the logic that deals with the scoreboard, whether it's done or not, to handle it being variable time. And this might also be a thing that, is part of how our data cache works, if we want to handle, this is the kind of mechanism we might use to handle cache misses. Though, as I mentioned, the data cache could be pipelined, and typically for the hit case, we'll have it be pipelined. But we'll have some logic like this to handle what if it's stalling from a miss. This is how we'll have some wires to inform the issue logic. Hey, that thing you thought might be ready, it's not. Sorry. So questions about our execution units. Timing. So let's apply this to another example. We probably won't go through the whole thing here, but to show how our pipelined execution units affect our instruction dispatch. So in this example, I'm going to say I have 2 ALUs that can do simple instructions, additions, compares, and conditional jumps, condition code evaluation for conditional jumps. And I have 1 ALU that does multiplies and is a 2-cycle pipelined ALU. So we can have 1 instruction in stage 1 of that multiply and 1 instruction in stage 2. And I'm going to look for instructions I can run. And I'm going to do my same thing. We're going to say, is register 1 ready? Yes. Is register 2 ready? Yes. Is register 4 ready? Yes. Is register 5 ready? And so on, and go through all the instructions. And at the beginning, it turns out that there are only two instructions that we can usefully run, and they're instruction one and two. And filling in this timeline, I know if I put a multiply in stage one during cycle one, it's going to be in stage two during cycle two. And that means that at the end of cycle two, that's when the first time we can use the result of the multiply to actually do something. And so when we're looking to dispatch the next cycle, I'm going to say, well, this add here, that's going to finish, and that's going to mean that register three is ready. But this multiply, it's not finished. It still has to go through the second stage. So I'm not going to change anything about register six. Register six, I'm still going to list as pending until I know that that multiply has gone through all the stages. And then I'm going to evaluate the instructions again. And I'm going to say, find out that I can run the multiply instruction three, that I can run the add instruction six. I can't run start, it's not even a candidate to run the things that depend on register six because it's not ready yet. Then I go to my next cycle, and I'm going to look for what instructions I can run. And I'm going to say, okay, well, register three is ready. That was what instruction one did. Register eight is not ready because it's computed by instruction three, which is still working on its multiply. So I'm not going to be able to issue instruction four. Instruction 5, register 9 isn't ready. That's going to be produced by instruction 4. Instruction 7, register 6, 4 is ready. And register 6 is finally ready because instruction 2 just finished. And we'll be able to issue instruction 7. So we'll be forwarding the value from instruction 2 to instruction 7 of register 6. That just became ready. But register 8 is still being computed, even though we issued the instruction to compute it last cycle. So we're going to have to do this extra bookkeeping to take into account, oh, yep, even though I can send a new instruction every cycle, that doesn't mean they complete immediately. And we'll use our scoreboard and being careful about how we update our scoreboard to account for those effects. And if we have to deal with an execution unit, which takes variable time, we'll need some signals from that execution unit to know when to update the scoreboard. So questions here? Yes.
What stops there from being so many registers pending that there's nothing you can do?
Question, what stops there from being so many registers pending that there's nothing you can do? Nothing. So when the processors design these systems, they have to choose how many physical registers there are, how big the instruction queues are, how big the reorder buffer is, and so on. And typically they'll make that choice, so typically that there's not any one thing which is always a bottleneck. But that's how they manage that problem. Does that answer your question?
So would you ever have a deadlock?
Question, would I ever have a deadlock? There's no deadlock because we'll always make the registers be ready by finishing instructions. And once enough instructions get finished, we'll always be able to commit more instructions, and that will free up some registers to be used. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So one other piece in this kind of instruction dispatch step, and it's kind of something I, you know, hinted at in showing the conditional jumps and the compares, and that's that a lot of instructions have these hidden inputs. So we saw the condition codes, right, were an input to our conditional jump and an output of our compare. And we really want to take those into account when we're running instructions, issuing instructions. So what we'll do is we'll add those and make them explicit as part of our register renaming step. So even though a compare doesn't have an output where the condition codes go, we will make a physical register to hold it. And then we can use our logic with the scoreboard to figure out when something like a conditional jump that needs those condition codes needs to run. And if we're doing this kind of sort of converting instructions from one form to another, we can take advantage of this to deal with some complex instructions. For example, the pop instruction on an x86 is kind of complicated. It does an add and a memory access. And you saw I was trying to like have a data cache and an ALU be separate. It's kind of annoying to have combine those into one thing. Well, we can avoid having an execution unit that actually knows how to do all the things a pop does by, in our register renaming step, rewriting the pop as simpler instructions. And this idea, Intel likes calling micro-ops, micro-operations. So this is a very common idea to handle architectures like x86, where you know the assembly has some pretty complicated instructions. We can handle those in the renaming step and make the rest of the pipeline deal with only these simpler forms of these instructions. So questions on this micro operation idea? Okay, so that's kind of our overview of out-of-order execution. And out-of-order execution, like, doesn't get us unlimited performance. And there are kind of two types of limits we run into. One is kind of a software limit, that our programs just don't always have work to do. Like, our out-of-order processor, we want to do like 20 things at once, maybe. We could build that processor, but most programs won't have 20 operations to do at once pretty much ever. The programmer can help us or hurt us in doing this, but you know, typical programs have this limit that we'll reach where we run out of stuff to do in parallel or stuff to do ahead of the current instruction. The other issue is that we need to have hardware structures for all the bookkeeping. And kind of fundamentally, if we're going ahead 200 instructions, we need to handle the case where what if instruction one doesn't work? Like if it's seg faults, or what if instruction two is a mispredicted branch? We need to keep the history all the way back to the last uncommitted instruction. And we need a data structure big enough to do that. And we also need to track all the output values that we haven't proven that we don't need anymore. So, this is going to affect how big our hardware is, and at some point, it's not going to be worth making these structures bigger. So, for example, Intel Skylake, which is from a while ago, has... I have this slide for this. Maybe I don't have this slide. Maybe I don't. But it has a reorder buffer with 224 entries, so it can look about 200 instructions ahead. And it has 168 physical registers for both integers and floating points. So two register files, each with 168 registers. That's pretty big already. That's 2015. They've gotten a little bigger, but there's only so big you can get and make the performance of these big structures acceptable. And you're getting kind of marginal improvement, like if we increase that 224 entry reorder buffer to 500, that's not going to double our performance. It's only going to help us kind of in edge cases. Another issue is that to fill all these instruction queues and buffers and register files, we rely on having good branch prediction. And when we get those branch predictions wrong, we're going to pay a bigger cost because it's going to be longer between when we made the branch prediction and when we figure out the branch prediction was wrong. You know, so with our pipeline processor, that cost was 2 cycles. With an out-of-order processor, in kind of the bad cases, it might be like 16 cycles. Of 16 cycles that of time we're wasting writing instructions that aren't useful, like that might, would not be uncommon. And talking about that, let's talk about sort of looking at our how branch prediction helps our pipeline processor. Well, before I do that, just let's take so out of order processor questions, because I'm going to transition to talking about branch prediction. Yeah. Where were they getting marked as pending? That's going to be part of what the process, I guess, that's going to be probably part of freeing up the register after it's done being used, most likely. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so let's think about our pipeline processor. So we're going to start simple. So I'm going to look at how does branch prediction help the performance of our pipeline processor? And we'll talk a little bit briefly about why this is, you know, why this effect is going to be much bigger in our out-of-order processor. And let's say I have a stupid branch predictor. My stupid branch predictor is I'm going to predict every branch is not taken. And I'm going to compare that to the idea we mentioned before we did branch prediction, that we could just stall. We could just not fetch instructions until we know where we need to go. And if I want to analyze how fast that is, well, I can say, let's think about our instructions. And let's say that my program has 92% instructions that aren't conditional jumps. It has 5% instructions that are not taken jumps, and we predict those correctly. In our, with prediction, we don't without. And it has 3% ones which are taken jumps, conditional jumps, that we predict incorrectly. And so notice that I'm doing the stupidest simple prediction here, where my prediction is I just don't have anything in the fetch stage to handle it. I just increment the PC. And I'm showing here kind of the effective time instructions take. So we know the instruction actually takes 5 cycles, but I'm showing the time until we fetch the next instruction. So normally, it takes us 1 cycle from when we fetch one instruction to when we fetch the next. And with a correct prediction, it takes us 1 cycle. With an incorrect prediction, my assumption is that we're going to fetch something, fetch another thing, but these are wrong. So it's going to be 3 cycles before we fetch the correct something useful. We're going to fetch something in 1 cycle, but it's not useful. The time between useful instruction fetches is 3 cycles. Versus 1 with a good prediction. And if we just stall, well, then we just waste 2 cycles, and then once we figure out the result of the prediction, we do it. So we'd spend 3 cycles regardless. And so since I'm computing the time between when we fetch instructions, this kind of tells us our rate of starting instructions, which is going to be, in the long run, the same as our rate of completing instructions. So with prediction, I'm going to take 3 cycles, 3% of the time, to to basically run an instruction, the time between the two instructions. One cycle, 5% of the time, and one cycle, 92% of the time, assuming other instructions don't have any hazards, which that requires waiting, which maybe is true, maybe it's not. And that would give me 1.06 cycles per instruction. If I instead do the no prediction strategy, I take three cycles, 3% of the time. I take three cycles in the cases I'm predicting correctly, and one cycle rest of the time. So I take 1.16 cycles per instruction. That's my throughput. And 1.16 over 1.06, that's about sort of a 9% improvement. So with our stupid simple branch predictor, we got a 9% performance improvement. And we could make this a lot better if we, you know, got this three number down. Also, if we think about out of order processors, you know, we might say, 9%, yeah, it's significant, it's not very big. But with our out of order processors, well, we can replace this number, is probably going to be, and this number, right? This 3, it's not going to be 3. We have this much longer pipeline the instructions go through before we detect a misprediction. Like that might be like 10, 15 cycles. So that's going to make the difference a lot bigger. And also, kind of our baseline time, this 1 here, right, these 1s, they're actually like a half or a third because we can complete multiple instructions per cycle. So on an out-of-order processor, this 9% difference explodes to something huge. And it's going to really matter that we do branch prediction, and it's going to really, really benefit us to do branch prediction well. And so if you look at a modern out-of-order processor, they spend a lot of effort on getting the branch prediction work because it has a very big impact on the performance. Whereas in these old pipeline processors, they often use very simple branch predictors because that was plenty good for their scenario. So questions on my calculation here. Everyone comfortable if you had to do another one of these hypothetically on an exam or quiz? Okay, so we're going to talk a little about, for our remaining time, some strategies for doing branch prediction. And kind of the simplest thing we can do is we can do branch prediction where we just look at the instruction and make a guess. And this is called static because it doesn't rely on changing information, just the information in the program as it sits. And the key strategy for static branch prediction is forward not taken, backward taken. And we'll see in a lot of cases, if you want to think about branch prediction strategies, what we'll think about is, how does this work for loops? Why do we look at loops? Because, well, they're a majority of our conditional jumps, or branches in general. And in a loop, if we have a conditional jump backwards, that's part of the loop, it's probably taken, assuming the loop runs a bunch of times. And if the loop doesn't run a bunch of times, we probably care a lot less if it runs slowly. So we'll predict that it gets taken. And if we have a jump forward that's part of the loop's logic, then we will predict that it's not taken, because if the loop runs a bunch of times, then it's not taken a bunch of times. And if the loop doesn't run a bunch of times, we probably don't really care. So this is basically the best we can do without what's called dynamic information, where we're going to look at what happened recently. So let's talk about probably the simplest predictor where we're going to look at what happened recently. And the idea we're going to have is that for every conditional jump, I want to predict that what this is going to do now is the same thing that happened last time. I'm just going to say, usually this jump is taken, or usually it's not taken. I want to figure that out and make that prediction. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the program counter value of the branch, put it through a hash function, and I'm going to have a table of outcomes that I'm going to update, and we'll see exactly how. And you might say, gosh, a hash function, so we're going to do some like fancy addition and multiplication and all that. No. This hash function is typically going to be something super fast. In this example, we'll use a realistic choice of just taking a few bits of the PC. In fact, we'll just take this 2 as our hash, this second to last hex digit. So I look that up. I find a value in this table. That's my prediction. And I'm going to send that to the fetch stage, have the fetch stage figure out what instruction to fetch next. And, well, that's pretty useful, except it might be wrong. And if it is wrong, well, we're going to have some later stage feed back into this table and update that entry we used to fill in. For example, you know, if it was actually not taken, we'll adjust the table entry to say not taken. So let's go through an example here where we have this loop, which is the assembly version of countdown from 4 to 0 and loop, well, the counter is greater than 0. And let's say we run this loop the first time and it's initially not taken. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to get our prediction. We're going to look up when we fetch this instruction. We're going to look it up with this in this table. We're going to find not taken. We're going to send that to the fetch stage. And we're initially going to start fetching over here, fetching the later instructions after the loop. But eventually we'll figure out, whoops, that was a mistake. And we'll figure out that it was actually supposed to be taken. We were actually supposed to go back here. And when we figure that out, we will send that outcome into the table and update the table entry to say, nope, it was not taken. And that's good, because after we correct our mistake and keep going through the loop, I did this wrong. This is so taken. Should be taken. We'll predict it as taken and send that prediction for cycle 2, in which case, iteration 2 of the loop, where it will be correct. You know, and we won't have any updates to do. And our prediction will continue being correct until iteration 4, when I becomes 0, which case we'll predict as taken and we'll get not taken. And kind of our overall outcome, which might be a little disappointing, is that we'll end up predicting correctly all the middle iterations of the loop, but we'll always get the first and the last wrong. We'll get the first wrong because the last time we ran the loop, we jumped out of it. We'll get the last wrong because all the previous iterations continue the loop and we don't. But every other case, we will get correct with this simple predictor. And we probably won't cover it, but we can extend this information in this table a little bit to fix this problem and make it not wrong as often. And that is what real processors will do, because even though you might say, yeah, that's pretty good, especially if this loop is like I equals 10, but that's not good enough for a modern processor. They want to get even the first and last iteration mostly correct. Now, a complaint you might have about my design here is that I'm doing this hash function, and I'm not doing something you expect if you remember your hash tables. In a hash table, like, we check whether the key actually matches before using it. And here, I'm just using it no matter what. And we definitely will have multiple conditional jumps that hash to the same entry. And we could fix this. So the direct map cache, we can kind of think of as hashing to a set, and we have tag bits to tell us if it's actually there or not. We could do the same idea in our branch prediction table. But it's just not worth it. One reason why it's not worth it is that the tag is going to be like 40 bits versus our table entry, which in this case was 1 bit. There are more information we might want to put in the table, but it's still going to be pretty small. It's still going to be a handful of bits. So the tag would make this table so much bigger and therefore slower or smaller. So it's not worth it. And the other reason it's not worth it is if we think of what happens when there is a collision, it's not that bad. With a data cache, if we didn't resolve this problem, we'd read the wrong value. That is unacceptable, no matter how much slower it makes our processor to fix it. It's unacceptable to read the wrong value. If we have a collision in the table, we kind of have three possibilities. So one possibility is the branch is usually taken. So in that case, it actually helps, because one branch that maps to that entry will make sure it's usually marked as taken, and the other one will read that taken thing, and it will get a better prediction even. And we'll have the same effect if both branches kind of are usually not taken. The only problem is if the branches kind of conflict. In that case, the performance is worse, but we're just making a wrong prediction. We're just affecting the performance. The correctness is fine, and it doesn't happen too often. So we're not going to be worried about it. And another thing we can think about is, well, we could fix the problem and eliminate possibility three, or we could make our table like 100 times as big, and therefore make item three happen way less often anyways, and also make all the normal cases where there isn't a collision also probably better. The other thing is that more sophisticated branch predictors, which we probably won't have time to talk about, but something you can do, you know, as kind of a high-level outline, is we can make a data structure which detects if I see taken, not taken, taken, not taken. We could make something that looks for those patterns, and that's something that modern processors do, and when you're doing that kind of prediction, possibility three isn't a problem either. So we're not going to care about these collisions. It's just going to work out. We're going to, you know, it might make our predictions worse, but that's all it can do. Our program will still run correctly. And all the bookkeeping we could do to avoid them, we'll just spend that effort on making our tables bigger or identify more sophisticated patterns or something like that. So let's look through an example with this loop here. So let's start, let's say we're using our 1-bit predictor. Let's review what we know about it. And I have two conditional jumps here in this loop, one which exits the loop and one which skips over part of the loop. Probably this would really have been if and a do while I doesn't equal 50, but I've written it out in a way where it's looks more like a conditional jump instruction. So my question is, what's our missed prediction rate for the I equals 3 equal to 0? So to figure that out, I'm going to say, okay, so let's think about the loop running. So iteration, the first iteration, we're going to have I equal to 0. And we're going to predict for, I don't know, because, well, we're predicting based on what happened last. It's hard to figure out what would have happened last. So is the first time the loop's running, we don't know. You know, some junk. And then our outcome is actually going to be that it is taken, and that is, I'll have a correct column, we don't know. Then in the next second iteration, I is going to be 1, and we're going to predict it as take n, because we're just predicting with that one bit, yes or no, taken, not taken predictor. We're going to say, yeah, it's taken. And the actual outcome is going to be that it's not taken, because 1 mod 3 is 1, not 0. And that's incorrect. And I can continue filling in that table like so. And so we'll see in this case, this happens to do pretty poorly. That we're going to have this pattern where it's no. No, yes, no, no, yes. And we're going to get about, 1/3 correct. A little different because of the 50 not being a multiple. Wait, but that's about how often we're going to predict this correctly. Questions on how to figure that out? Okay. So how about the same question for the other conditional jump? What is our misprediction rate here? Or correct prediction rate. And the final question is, what's the overall rate? Current predictions. Would you like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we're gonna mispredict at least 2% of the time? At least 4% of the time? At least 6% of the time? Okay, no clue? Okay, so that's a mix of them. So let's work through what happens for this branch here. So when I equals 0, when I equals 1, so the first iteration of the loop, I equals 1, we're going to check if it's equal to 50, and we're going to find out that we're going to have a prediction and our actual outcome, and was this correct? And our prediction, well, we don't know. I'll get back to this question later about what the prediction would have been, but we don't know it. But the actual outcome is not taken, that we don't go into the if statement. And was this correct? The answer is we don't. When I equals 2, we're going to predict it the same as the last time. So we're going to predict it as not taken. I'll represent that with an N. And the actual outcome will be that it's not taken, so this is correct. When I equals 3, we're going to predict it as not taken. That will be correct. And this will happen all the way up till I equals 49. Where we'll have it predicted as not taken, and it will be not taken. That will be correct. And then when I becomes 50 down here, we'll predict it as not taken, but it will be taken, and that'll be incorrect. So that gives me kind of a minimum miss rate of, you know, this is 2% by itself. Since we have 1 to 50, that's 2% of our total conditional jumps for this I equals 50. Now let's think about the beginning here. So if we are running this code, this loop, in a bigger loop, then whenever we start the loop again, our prediction is going to be based, assuming there were no collisions, which we aren't sure about, but if there are no collisions, which is probably most likely, if like there's a loop, relatively tight loop around this, it's going to be based on what happened the last time we ran it. So last time we had I equals 50 and we made that misprediction, and we're going to predict based on the last time this loop ran that it's taken and it's not taken, and that will also be incorrect. So if we run this code over and over again, we're going to get 4% the first and last iteration of that I equals 50 check mispredicted. Assuming we have no collisions or other things with this one bit predictor, one bit or branch. And we can do something similar for this case here. We can say, well, in the last iteration of the loop, this is I equals 49. 49 mod 3 is not equal to 0. So we're going to predict it as not taken, which will be wrong. Questions, logic here. So we can combine all of this to get kind of the overall misprediction rate. You know, we're gonna, one way we could do it is we could make this very tedious long table with 100 entries, because there's 100 conditional jumps running this loop. Or we could kind of reason out what it's going to look like, that our mod 3 conditional jump is going to be correct for these indices, which is 16 out of 50 times, and the break is going to be correct 48 out of 50 times, so that gives us a 64% correct prediction rate. And that means that, you know, once 64 out of 100 times, right, we are not paying that misprediction penalty, and other times we are. So our actual correct prediction rate was kind of similar to this example, the correct prediction rate. Some questions about reasoning about our sort of simple branch predictor. Do they do significantly better than choosing one over the other? Yes. So there are kind of, yeah, I have in the slides we won't get to, I have some ways which aren't even close to state of the art which do way better. I guess I have time, so I can talk about kind of the simplest idea that kind of extends the simple predictor we had, which is rather than using one bit, use two bits, to kind of distinguish between it's usually taken, but it was not taken the last time, and it was not taken the last several times. So we can use what's called a saturating counter, where basically you know, if it's taken, was taken the last several times, it ends up at all ones. If it was not taken the last several times, it ends up at all zeros. But it means that we have to, you know, have a, see it not taken several times to keep predicting not taken. So that solves the big problem you saw with all those branches there, where we, you know, there was one exception to whether they were taken, and we kind of misread that as saying we should now predict them as not taken forever. And we can do more sophisticated things than that, which I probably have in slides here, of like looking for patterns is that. And these are not even close to state-of-the-art ideas. These are old, these are 1990s, 1980s, 70s. These are old, very old ideas. And the more current ones, like, I guess, they have, there's some newer ideas. So for example, there is a, you know, there's been a lot of interest in actual use of branch predictors based on simple neural networks. This is before the AI craze, like in the 90s. So that's one design which has actually been used commercially, and there's other sort of more sophisticated things. And the other thing is that we can use these ideas with bigger tables and things like that. So one thing that we haven't talked about that's adjacent to branch prediction is that we mentioned in our pipeline processor, we need to make our branch predictors before we decode the instruction. And even if it's not a conditional jump, we need to fetch the right thing next. And we'd like to do that immediately. We don't want to have to compute where does this call instruction go to. You know, or in the case of x86, probably spend a bunch of time finding out where the call instruction is in the machine code. So we're going to have a second type of prediction data structure called a branch target buffer. And the purpose of this is to be kind of a specialized cache for branch instructions. And the idea is that as we're fetching instructions, we can quickly look up in this cache without decoding the instruction and figure out what type of instruction it is. So let's say I'm fetching this call instruction. I would like to fetch the target of the call, the instructions at address 404033 next. I don't want to keep going in the program. That's wrong. And I'd like to do that without spending the time to have the call instruction go through several pipeline stages. So I waste time when, in an out-of-order processor, I could fetch like the 12 instructions in the function, maybe the entire function in that time. So what we'll do is we'll have this branch target buffer, this specialized cache, where we can look up using a cache-like lookup, like tag index offset, or tag and index, and figure out, oh, yeah, there was a call instruction there, and its target is this address, and we can very quickly figure out to go there to fetch the next thing. We can also use this to do our branch prediction without actually checking whether the instruction contains a conditional jump. We just remember last time we looked at this instruction, looked at this address, there was a conditional jump there. And once we know that from this table, we just trigger our branch prediction logic to decide whether to go to that target address or keep going. So this is kind of how we can do that trick where I said, oh, we're going to fetch instructions, and as we're fetching instructions, we'll predict the next instructions. This is how we can do that, and how we can make that work, you know, even if we have, for example, an instruction cache that takes multiple cycles to fetch. Questions about the branch target buffer? Okay, so that's where I will finish up for now. Next time, we're going to talk a bit about, and as our last topic for the semester, we're going to talk about side channels, and we're in particular going to talk about side channels with the aim of introducing you to Spectre, which has been kind of an attack on processors, which is kind of a side effect of implementing speculative execution, that we have these security bugs that wouldn't have existed if we didn't have these out-of-order processors. So we're going to talk about what that is and how it works as our last topic for the semester. And one logistical note, so there's a homework on the out-of-order stuff, which is mostly similar things to examples you saw in lecture. It is due before the last day of class, and there are no late submissions on it. We have an exam review the last day of class. I'd really like to be able to talk about the homework during that exam review and also not take a bunch of exam questions, which are really I'm doing the homework in class questions. So that's why it's due before class, and it's due before the first lecture. And like with the page table 2 assignment, normally late submissions will not be accepted. And you can talk to me if you need that, but that's how that works. So anything else before I finish up? Okay, so that's it. See you all next week.